You were American, you wouldn't be behind barbed wire with the rest of the Japanese.
That's WBAI Playhouse, Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m., September 18th. Houses on the Moon, Steve, followed by L.A. Theater Works' No No Boy, right here on WBAI New York.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, September 19th, 2021, at 1 p.m. The meeting will be by teleconference. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. The meeting ID number is 963-003. Everyone is welcome to call in and attend the meeting. Also, at the conclusion of the CAB meeting, there will be a WBAI-CAB Governance Committee meeting. The contact information is the same as the CAB meeting, the Community Advisory Board. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. The meeting ID is 963-003. Everyone is welcome to attend the meeting.
Mother Earth is occupied by the United States of Amazon. Call it surveillance capitalism. Sunday, September 19th, in New York City, come together for peaceful conversation on how to create a better tomorrow. Connect the dots from Assange to Mumia, COVID and climate, housing and policing, from Afghanistan to Yemen. We're building coalitions. Black Lives Matter and Code Pink to Extinction Rebellion and Veterans for Peace, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, and more. Join us Sunday, September 19th, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in Foley Square. I'm Zul, and I'm a whistleblower for justice, people, and planet. RisingTogether.info for more information.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
Coming up on WBAI, Jim Freund and Hour of the Wolf. The Hour of the Wolf today is a rebroadcast.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning we will hear an interview and a reading from Charles Yu from his National Book Award-winning novel, Interior Chinatown. But first, a review from Dan Persons.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. There are two sisters in the new film, Silence and Darkness, which is now available on demand. Anna, played by Mina Walker, is blind and has an obsession with music, especially the songs of Bob Dylan. Beth, played by Joan Glacken, is deaf, but spends her days performing cartwheels in the yard of their beautiful yet isolated home. They live an idyllic life with their loving father, a doctor, played by Jordan Lage, who is diligent in making sure they want for nothing, is meticulous in keeping up their education, and who, about a half hour into the film, tucks them into their beds. Even though both sisters are adults, they have very sibling-esque bunk beds, pulls out a syringe, and gives the two women injections that render them comatose into the next day. And that moment, and the scenes that follow showing father, the film doesn't give him any other name, wrestling them around the house, should land like a hammer blow. And the reason it doesn't is that writer-director Barak Barkin has already shown us early on that something is not quite right with father. Near the beginning, we see him entertaining his daughters by singing, "At length, I've got you under my skin." Not long after, we see that he has an abusive, sexual relationship with an obsessive patient. It's a matter of taste, I guess. I would have preferred to have my mind blown when he injects the women. Instead, I was already prepped that the man was not what he seemed. And that's still okay, since Silence and Darkness is quite a finely calibrated, low-key, slow-burn exercise in dread. Both Walker and Glacken deliver fine performances as the sisters, and director Barkin cleverly documents their bonding through their use of sign language, which, because their disabilities require the use of touch, has an evocative, almost sensual immediacy. There are moments when I wondered whether the sisters were originally supposed to be younger. Some of the interactions between father and his daughters come out a little creepier than maybe even Barkin wanted. And a sequence at a talent show feels a little too much like an artist's envisioning of small-town life rather than the real thing. But altogether, Silence and Darkness earns its potent, disturbing final act. It's a film that's going to stick with me for quite a while. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. You're about to hear a rebroadcast of my interview with Charles Yu, the author of four books, including his latest, Interior Chinatown, which won the National Book Award for Fiction 2 weeks after we recorded this last November. It was also longlisted for the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. He has also been nominated for 2 Writers Guild of America awards for his work on the HBO series Westworld, and has also written for shows on FX, AMC, Facebook Watch, and Adult Swim. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in a number of publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Wired, and Harper's. You can find him on Twitter at @CHARLES_YU. One reason for this rebroadcast is that Charles will be the live guest at the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading, which will be on Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can join us on Facebook in the NYRSF Readings group or on YouTube in my videos section. But for now, set your way back machine to November for this talk with Charles Yu. Thank you, Dan. You're about to hear rebroadcasts of my interview with Charles Yu, the author of four books, including his latest, Interior Chinatown, which won the National Book Award for Fiction 2 weeks after we recorded this last November. It was also longlisted for the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. He has also been nominated for 2 Writers Guild of America awards for his work on the HBO series Westworld, and has also written for shows on FX, AMC, Facebook Watch, and Adult Swim. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in a number of publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Wired, and Harper's. You can find him on Twitter at @CHARLES_YU. One reason for this rebroadcast is that Charles will be the live guest at the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading, which will be on Tuesday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can join us on Facebook in the NYRSF Readings group or on YouTube in my videos section. But for now, set your way back machine to November for this talk with Charles Yu. I guess the first question is, what is most recent?
Imminent?
In terms of my work?
Yes. Or your life?
Well, my life has, like everyone else, has been, it's been a pretty surreal year. And recently I've been working on a number of projects for television development, including, it was just announced publicly anyway, a deal with Hulu to adapt my most recent book, Interior Chinatown, for television, or for streaming, I guess. So that's what's been on my mind, and yeah, it's in a lot of ways a good time to be stuck at home, because it forces me to work more and not drive around to coffee shops and pretend to work, or, you know, I don't know, go out and see friends. I'm getting a lot of work done, or at least I'm spending a lot more time in front of my computer than I would otherwise. So I suppose that's a good thing.
Well, you started out primarily as a prose writer.
Right.
And correct me, when I say something that's simply like ignorant, which I do all the time. And then...
So do I.
And then maybe 5 years ago, lo and behold, you're the story editor of Westworld?
Yes. Yeah, I started out writing short stories, and then eventually started, after a few years of publishing those stories, got to publish a collection. And so I've been publishing stories and books since about 2002. And somewhere along the way, about 10 years ago, right after I had published my second book, which is titled How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, it's a novel, it's a time travel story that's really sort of a family story and a father-son story about a time machine that's powered by regret and memory. And so it's a form of emotional and mental time travel. After I published that book, I had a bit of sort of interest from TV and film people, and got to go on a few meetings with development executives and producers and that sort of thing. And through that, I started to, basically get to know people in Los Angeles that work in that field. And so occasionally, like a couple of times a year, I'd get a call from, my film and TV agents, who would say, so-and-so would, like to meet with you. And it was always this like really surprising thing because, you know, here I am like stuck on a book or stuck on something. And I also, I should mention at the time, I'm still working full time as a lawyer. So I'd get these calls out of the blue and I'd go on these meetings. And usually they were the same. They were an hour of like really pleasant, you know, good conversation that would then lead with me going home and saying, what was that? You know, what do I do now? And really kind of having no idea how to convert any of that interest or enthusiasm into, you know, an actual job or a script or something. But anyway, after a few years of that, I did end up getting this call, again, completely out of the blue, to come for an interview to meet with the showrunners of this show, Westworld. And I was, you know, both shocked and also really nervous because I thought, well, this is something that I would actually, you know, if I got this job, I could actually leave my job as a lawyer, which was a bit scary, to be honest, because, you know, I have kids, or we had kids at that point, and my wife and I. And so, but first things first, I had to get the job. I went in for the meeting and I got the job somehow. And yeah, that's how that happened. That was 2014. And so I've been working in TV since then.
Wow. That's sort of amazing. But you're still writing.
I am.
Prose,
yeah.
I mean.
I am, definitely. I at the time I got the job, I was a couple of years into the novel that I just published that I mentioned, Interior Chinatown. I was a couple of years into it. And at that point, I thought I was almost done in 2014. Several years later, I actually was done. And so, but yes, throughout, you know, the last few years of working in TV, so I left my job as a lawyer after, you know, over a decade of being a lawyer. And I got a new day job, which was TV, and I had to learn the ropes. And in a lot of ways, I'm still learning the ropes. But meanwhile, I was trying to write, still trying to write the book, and finally got it done after several years of kind of failed attempts and hundreds of pages of like drafts that just sort of didn't go anywhere. So yeah, I'm still writing, publishing short stories and even some nonfiction, which I've had a couple opportunities to write essays and that sort of thing. So I like doing it all. I think those two things, the fiction and the TV, they feed each other in a lot of ways. It keeps it fresh.
Yeah, there's a lot in your stories and especially the latest novel that speak to the industry, as it were, the typing of people and all of that world of how an Asian person ends up in what roles, delivery man or whatever it may be, background oriental male and a delivery guy. I'm just taking a look. And then you actually started appearing on TV a tiny bit.
So far just once, and I would honestly be happy not to do it again for a long time. It's pretty scary, actually, to be on that side. I've been on set for work, and that's fun, but being on camera is...
A tough question, I guess. Is there anything that any itch you have not yet scratched that you would like to, like theater or?
Oh wow, theater in particular. I've had people say, "Have you tried? Have you thought about writing a play or adapting? You know, some of your like a short story." Or even a novel for a stage performance. It's really daunting, but I think I'd love to try it someday. I probably right now I have my hands full, but I don't know exactly how and when I'd find my way to it, but I suspect that I will try because it does seem exciting to try something new and scary, but also not that scary, because if it like were a total flop, I mean, not, I don't mean commercially, I'm saying just if it were a flop on my hard drive, if I just wrote something and I said, oh, that's terrible, then no one would have to know about it. I would just like keep it to myself, no pressure. So, and I think the main itch that is interesting to me are right now is also nonfiction writing. I think I'm, you know, I've always loved writing or reading about science. I was a science major in college. I wasn't like a great student. That's part of why I went to law school instead of grad school or med school. But I remain, you know, like just as curious and just as like, I just love reading about, you know, science. And so I think it'd be fun to try to write. I don't know how and when that would happen either, but somewhere or somehow about something scientific or a project or who knows. So yeah, if there's any science editors out there who are looking for a random novelist's take on anything, then maybe they could get in touch. But yeah, I suspect most likely it would happen by me getting really interested in something and following, you know, going down a rabbit hole.
The questions I have, they are way too far reaching because you're writing goes to so many amazing places.
I like far-reaching questions. I'm not afraid of them.
Okay, if somebody came from who knows what universe and asked what it is that you do aside from simply writing, how would you describe yourself as a writer? What is your bailiwick?
Oh, wow. It's,
I told you it was a stupid, far-reaching question.
No, I love it. One, I've never gotten that actual question, at least not formulated that way. So it's always fun to, you know, grapple with something that you haven't grappled with. Sometimes the challenge is to say the same thing that you've said 20 times in a way that doesn't sound exactly the same way. And this is a different challenge. This is actually trying to, on the fly, if you can't tell, I'm vamping so that I can come up with a coherent answer. But this is on the fly trying to come up with, you know, a characterization of my own writing. I mean, I guess one way to think about it is, not to get too meta, but it is a little bit like exploring an adjacent, you know, universe. It's trying to find other realities that feel like, you know, that have one or more of, you know, characteristics, which I would say is they are interesting, hopefully, and or at least interesting to me, and have enough of a tangent point or, you know, overlap or resonance with our universe that there's something interesting in the act of writing about that universe for a resident of this one, if that makes any sense. So, you know, and I don't know that the second part necessarily is true for everyone. I think there's probably writers who the point is to write about a universe that feels very far, far away from this one, or is really strange and jarringly so, or
well,
not.
You had an article in The Atlantic that spoke to that. called The Pre-Pandemic Universe Was the Fiction.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was, you know, one example of some of the nonfiction that I've been trying to do, especially during this year where it feels like to write about a fictional universe feels not at all frivolous. It's never a waste of time, but it feels strange to, or it's just hard to be pulling my mind out of what's going on in this one, you know, when, and then it sort of, in the course of writing that piece, it made me realize, well, you know, how much do I sort of already do this? You know, how much do I already kind of take, you know, take what I should be looking at and try to rearrange it or twist it, and when instead I should just be looking at what's right in front of me and trying to make sense of that. And so I guess that's a little bit of where the impulse in writing nonfiction comes. I mean, just to quickly summarize that piece for anyone who hasn't read it, you know, the idea there was to think about how much what I regarded as my, quote, normal life before this pandemic was actually an anomaly, really, right? I mean, to live, to have lived 40-some years in the, with the amount of stability and, well, basically stability, right? In this kind of bubble of comfort and privilege and security that I had existed in. And granted, I'm beyond just being an American and relatively privileged socioeconomically, I think I was also like generationally privileged. I just was born in a time where there just haven't been as much in the way of upheavals for someone like me who has grown up in the suburbs and, you know, kind of skated through a lot of decades without anything like this happening. So it was, the piece is really just me kind of reflecting on, well, it feels a little bit like this bubble of unreality has popped. And now I'm actually, you know, in a lot of ways for the first time as like a middle-aged person thinking about my life differently. Like, oh, it doesn't have to go the way it has. There doesn't have to be a return to any kind of normalcy, you know, however you define that. I had embedded, you know, I had a lot of embedded assumptions about like sort of what life is supposed to be like. And this year has really, you know, completely put those, you know, just made those seem silly.
Yeah, this was not, well, I mean, some people did see where this was coming. Connie Willis, in the third book of her Oxford Time Travel trilogy, just out of nowhere, talks about as people have gone through all the different places they have been in the past and come back to their world, which is our near future, there's a pandemic. And all too closely relates to the world we're living in. Well, and of course, in the world of science fiction, I think we've all seen Trump.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if the two of them should coincide is an even greater unhappiness.
That's a choice word for it. A very unfortunate coincidence of the exact worst possible person to be in charge of this type of catastrophe, you know, or cataclysm, right? He turned it into a catastrophe. And people that have enabled him or otherwise supported him. So, and yeah, I, you're right, though. It was foreseeable. I mean, that's one thing that I had written in the Atlantic essay that I have actually regretted since was I wrote a little bit, I think I have a line about how we hadn't foreseen it. And I think most people like me, you know, sort of uninformed, you know, about things that I probably should have been more informed about. But of course, there were people like epidemiologists or, like you're saying, Connie Willis and other sort of far-seeing writers, people like Bill Gates, you know, people knew that this was definitely a possibility. And it's so unfortunate that one, more people didn't understand. I mean, I think it's also completely understandable. You know, I think just based on, you know, cognitive, our sort of biases, right? Things like this don't feel possible. Like, we underestimate, I think, the probability of things like this happening, and probably also underestimate the amount which our lives can actually be, you know, changed by them, like the amount of upheaval or damage that can be caused. And yet it is, by definition, foreseeable because people have written about it and people were talking about it. And it just, you know, hopefully there's learning that goes on so that even though there will always be a next thing that will take us by surprise, at least maybe systems or other measures that could be put in place so that the next pandemic doesn't take us so much by surprise. But first we have to get through this one, right? I mean, we're not even close to out of the woods, so
it's scary. So yeah. Something a little more uplifting, maybe.
Okay. Sure.
We were indirectly associated because I'm also the podcast editor and host of the Lightspeed Magazine podcast.
Wow.
And you've had any number of short stories with us.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Were you thinking of perhaps reading for us?
But I'm happy to.
Interior, Golden Palace. Ever since you were a boy, you've dreamt of being Kung Fu Guy. You're not Kung Fu Guy. You are currently background Oriental male, but you've been practicing. Maybe tomorrow will be the day. Interior, Golden Palace. Ever since you were a boy, you've dreamt of being Kung Fu Guy. You're not Kung Fu Guy. You are currently Oriental guy making a weird face, but you've been practicing. Maybe tomorrow will be the day. Take what you can get. Try to build a life. A life at the margin, made from bit parts. Willis Wu, Asian actor. Skills. Kung Fu, moderate proficiency. Fluent in accented English. Able to do face of great shame on command. Resume. Disgraced son. Delivery guy. Silent henchman. Caught between two worlds. Guy who runs in and gets kicked in the face. Striving immigrant. Generic Asian man. Your mother is played in no particular order. Pretty Oriental flower. Asiatic seductress, young dragon lady, slightly less young dragon lady, restaurant hostess, girl with the almond eyes, beautiful maiden number one, dead beautiful maiden number one, old Asian woman. Your father has been, at various times, twin dragon, wizened Chinaman, guy in a soiled t-shirt, inscrutable grocery owner in a soiled t-shirt. Egg roll cook. Young Asian man. Shifu, the mysterious kung fu master. Old Asian man. Interior Golden Palace, morning. In the world of black and white, everyone starts out as generic Asian man. Everyone who looks like you, anyway. Unless you're a woman, in which case you start out as pretty Asian woman. You all work at Golden Palace, formerly Jade Palace, formerly Palace of Good Fortune. There's an aquarium in the front and cloudy tanks of rock crabs and 2-pound lobsters crawling over each other in the back. Laminated menus offer the lunch special, which comes with a bowl of fluffy white rice and choice of soup, egg drop, or hot and sour. A neon Qingdao sign blinks and buzzes behind the bar in the dimly lit space, a dropped ceiling room with lacquered ornate woodwork, or some imitation thereof, everything simmering in a warm, seedy red glow, thrown off by the dollar store paper lanterns festooned above, many of them darkened by dead moths, the paper yellowing, ripped, curling in on itself. The bar is fully stocked with top-shelf spirits up top, middle-shelf liquor at eye level, and down at the bottom, a happy hour shelf of booze that you will regret for sure. The new thing everyone is excited about is called Lychee Margarita Tini, which seems like a lot of flavors. Now that you've had one, they're $14. Sometimes patrons leave a sip at the bottom of the glass, and if you're quick while you go through the swinging door that separates the front of the house from the back, you can have a taste. You've seen some of the other generic Asian men do it. It's a risk, though. Their director's always got an eye out, ready to fire someone for the smallest infraction. You wear the uniform. White shirt, black pants. Black slipper-like shoes that have no traction whatsoever. Your haircut is not good, to say the least. Black and white always look good. A lot of it has to do with the light. They're the heroes. They get the hero lighting, designed to hit their faces just right. Designed to hit white's face just right, anyway. Someday you want the light to hit your face like that. To look like the hero. Or, for a moment, to actually be the hero.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. The show is Hour of the Wolf, and my name is Jim Freund. We will now continue with the recent interview we had with the recipient for this year's National Book Award for Fiction winner, Charles Yu. Are you able, with the writing that you are doing and all the TV work, are you able to continue the TV work at this time?
I am, but only because the projects that I'm working on are at the development stage. So there's no need for any pre-production or production. So, I don't know how much actual production is going on yet. I think some is going on overseas. I think some is going on, but with a lot of restrictions.
They're creating bubbles, where people, sit around for 2 to 3 weeks before they go into production, and then they try to shoot a series, a season anyway, in a matter of about 2 months, and then they figure out how their post-production will go.
Yeah, that seems really challenging, because production is hard enough as it is. If things drag on, for many, many more months, I wonder how much the pipeline will start to, show, the lack of material coming through. Because as of right now, there's still so much. I think there's enough of a backlog that things are still coming out. But the projects I'm working on are still in the writing phase. So it'll be a while before any of them, would be in production anyway. Now, if I suddenly wake up to, one of my partners saying, yeah, we got a series order, I don't know when and how that would start, because it just seems like how much can you get done in this environment?
Well people, they're optimistic. You hear about things being optioned all the time.
Yeah.
And I read about it and I'm going, no, that's not going to happen. Noah Hawley is not going to be doing a Star Trek movie in January. Which I have read, and I don't think that was him saying it either. It's just people being optimistic.
As much as I'd like that to happen, because I remember reading about that, just thinking, oh my God, what a combination. That's
Well, the idea that Noah Hawley is working on one Star Trek thing and Quentin Tarantino another.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
That's about as realistic as one can get.
Yeah. It's a really neat approach that it feels like it, you know, involves different, you know, people who have made brilliant original things to then come and try their hand at an existing, you know, universe. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good question, because you have been writing into other people's universes, both in prose and in media.
Yeah.
Versus your own. I mean, now here's an all-encompassing question. You have written novels, you've written short stories, screenplays, with any luck, a play, with any luck, some major nonfiction. What do you like the most? Or what scratches that itch the most?
That is, I mean, I think my first love is still, will probably be the last one, which is writing prose fiction. I think a short story, you know, that is done and, or mm-hmm. is done as, feels done enough to share it with people is a uniquely satisfying feeling. I wish I could say the same of books, but I think they just take so long that, and I suspect that an essay could also feel that good. I think I've had that feeling too. I think there's something about writing and finishing something of that length in the time frame that it takes to write something like that, which is on the order of, you know, weeks to a few months maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That just feels like it takes, yeah, I don't know, maybe runners have their distances, you know, and some people like the ultra marathon and some people like the sprints, and there's a kind of distance for me, and that feels like it. But I so that's probably what is the most satisfying. But I'm also somebody who, like, as soon as you give me the opportunity to do something, then I want to go and try something else. Just, I don't know if it's a perverse instinct to just be contrary or it's a self-sabotaging thing to continually find new things that I then have to try to learn how to do with any kind of competence. And so, I don't know, I suspect I'll keep trying different things, but I'll never get tired of writing short stories and essays.
Yeah, I've got to say that's my favorite. It's always short stories. I read it all. I watch it all. I enjoy it all when it's good. But the short story, there's something very special about that, which is why the Lightspeed podcast is so much fun to work on. And, by the time this airs, the Fantasy Magazine podcast, which starts up again in November, but has been dormant for... a number of years now, but yeah, another one of John Joseph Adams' tentacles reaching out into the literary universe.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. James Gunn, and no kids, not the movie director of Guardians of the Galaxy. But the grand old man of the University of Kansas in Lawrence, who described the short story as the perfect form for science fiction, and how it's a polished gem.
Mm.
And that in a novel, you can meander, you can go into different places, you can take a look at what's around the corner, you can get into the backstory of somebody who isn't essential to the ultimate plot, but a short story doesn't have a wasted word.
Right.
And so,
or shouldn't.
Yeah, I've always been a big fan of that. So I loved your answer.
Great. I'm glad.
Not that it mattered that much that I did. I think I may have asked you this at the beginning, but I'll ask it again. What's coming out next? Interior Chinatown was January, and here we are we're in autumn.
Yeah. Well, currently on my desk is, or on my laptop, is me taking a crack at adapting Interior Chinatown for Hulu. So that's
right.
A new challenge. It's exciting. And
the only reason that annoys me is I don't have Hulu. I can't have every service.
Right. Well, if and when it gets to the air, then maybe there'll be a way to watch it. I don't know. Sometimes they make them available through Amazon. I actually don't know if that happens for
They do, but then you have to pay for it.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're a Prime member, you know, and then you can just, you know, you can buy it from Amazon, you can buy it from Google, anybody you like.
Yeah.
And at that point, you might as well be subscribing, but I already have like four services.
Yeah. I know. We haven't cut the cord on cable, and yet we also have pretty much every streamer, and I don't really even want to think about how expensive it actually is, although I do, you know, I think justifiably write it off as business expense. So
yes, I dare say at this point.
But it is pretty crazy how much entertainment we have at our disposal. My kids don't even know. I mean, they are so spoiled.
The idea of Interior Chinatown being a streaming series, though, is perfect because streaming series allow for a different form of screen storytelling that we've never been able to do before, the serialized story.
Yes, I agree. And I think that's one of the things that's really exciting as the writer who gets to try to do that. And I think also it's both a cause and probably an effect of why we're seeing different kinds of stories and also different kinds of writers in TV writers' rooms. You know, I've worked with a number of novelists and playwrights and even a couple of poets in writers' rooms. And because there's, as you point out, such a different, or not just one possibility, there's many different ways now to tell stories in a streaming model than there were when you had commercials and you had to wait a week in between. So that's pretty neat. And especially for someone who honestly couldn't, you know, make a living just off my fiction. I mean, that's why I kept my job as a lawyer until I started working in TV. So it's also a livelihood for me. So it's pretty neat in a couple of ways.
Well, officially, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line for a minute, but officially, as far as the radio show is concerned, we've already run over what I can do. I'm going to, you know, edit a lot of myself out and keep your voice in. And there'll also be an online version that won't be restricted.
Great.
But at this point, officially, I want to thank you so much. It's been ever since your first novel came out, I've been itching to interview you. I'm so pleased it happened. Thank you, Random Penguin, for facilitating it.
Yes, thank you indeed to Julie Ertl there and to the team there. And thank you for having me on. I'm so glad we got to finally meet, at least this way, and I hope we get to meet someday at some convention or something literary.
I would like that. Okay, thanks. Now stay on the line. We're done
sure.
recording. But I'm going to ask you if you are interested in being the reader for one of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
Oh. That sounds fun. Does that reading my own work or someone else's work?
Your own.
Oh, okay.
The format, you can go to Facebook and you can take a look. There's quite an archive there. The one we just had one with Chelsea Polk that was fun. It's usually reading for 20 to 25 minutes and then followed by an interview with one of three people, usually myself. We each take different roles, one person wrangling the questions, the other person being the tech support person, and the third being the host. And then we do a Q&A that comes through the chat channel. And it's and it happens live on both Facebook Live, and with one coming up that's going to be James Morrow the night before election night. Morrow is part of a new anthology called And the Trump Shall Sound. And that's going to be fun. But if you were to go to Facebook to the NYRSF Readings Group, that's New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which was something started by Gordon Van Gelder and Dave Hartwell 30 years ago. Last month was Michael Swanwick reading a novel that he finished for Gardner Dozois posthumously. And that was a lot of fun. And before that, we had Jack Dan for from Melbourne and so forth. So that's the current format. It used to be that people would congregate in a place and there would just be a reading and then elbow rubbing. But this is our new format. And as I say, the great thing is that we can now do this long distance.
Yeah. No, I'd love to. I don't know when your time frame is, but...
Well, we're the first Tuesday of every month.
Okay.
So it's a monthly event. And I'm booked for November. Mm-hmm. I have in mind people to do December, but from January on, we're open.
Great.
Russell's already done two of them.
Oh, wow.
But not in 9 years.
Okay. So she's due.
Yes, she is.
I see they're again, like your show, such a... The life list is really impressive. So it's exciting. I'd love to do it. Early next year would be great. So if that ends up working, you know, or whenever next year. Whenever
well, it's up to you to tell me the month, and I'll give it to you.
Okay. Okay.
It's that simple. Unless it falls on a holiday, and the problem with next month is the first Tuesday is Election Day.
Right.
And people might be a little distracted.
I have a new standalone science fiction short story coming out probably in January. So I wonder if that would work. But even if that doesn't work, I'm also happy to
that,
read.
That works for me. I mean, let me see what the date is. Call up my calendar. I'm also going to be bending, as you said, it's Karen's turn to return. First Tuesday of January is January 5th.
Hmm.
And if that would work for you, that's fine. But if
I think
have another, I'd rather go. February, it's Groundhog Day.
Oh, interesting. Can I...
Yeah, you don't have to answer now.
Check with them, yeah, because I don't know when. I think they might be releasing the story in mid-January, so if it weren't out yet, maybe February would work better. So let me check with them and see. I'll get back to you.
Hour of the Wolf was a rebroadcast this morning on WBAI, and coming up very shortly, we have David Rothenberg and Any Saturday. So stay right where you are at WBAI New York.
This is WBAI New York. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 27 listener candidates.
I'm Harriet Hines. I recently ran for a city council seat. I would like to give back by using my knowledge of organizational psychology and grant writing to help the board strengthen the station. Through my activism, I will shed light on racial injustice by bringing forth awareness of the community/nation by opposing Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams and Councilman Matthew Eugene's developing housing on top of the African burial ground in Flatbush, Brooklyn. Please vote for me and the other Justice and Unity candidates.
My name is John Hoffman. I owe a lot to WBAI. I attribute much of my outlook on life to what I've learned by listening to the station. I want to be able to give back to the station that has given so much to me. And because I have extensive experience I can offer in the finance and budgeting world, including being on the board of directors of my condo association, I want to help elevate the experience of the station and make sure it remains independent. I believe that building on the progress that has been made to stabilize the financial condition of the station is essential.
Come on, EA. This is Kim Ives. I'm a filmmaker and have worked in Haitian media for over 40 years, including WBAI's Haiti, The Struggle Continues, and L'Ambicol. In general, WBAI must reengage, expand our listenership, and renew interest, faith, and passion in the station's programming and mission. We must modernize the delivery of our programs, incorporate video, and simplify and streamline sharing on social media. WBAI is invaluable.
I'm Sarah Kleppner from New Jersey, asking WBAI to love the Garden State back. Please elect me to the local station board so I can translate my enthusiasm into organized growth activity. Our station can help forge pathways for all humanity at a time of sharpening political, economic, and environmental challenges. I'm a social justice activist and an adult educator with an interest in listener engagement. We need a board committed to working together.
My name is Dean Lauren, and I'm running because of the merger and acquisition attack on Pacifica Foundation. And the current attack is based on a bankruptcy model using legal lawsuits to bleed the cash and force an FJC loan default. The FJC loan default will trigger a refinancing by the lender that is, clean, and that will secure the loan with Pacifica Station's assets.
To learn more about WBAI's local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org. All ballots are due on Friday, October 15th. Make your voice heard.
Do that. The time now, 8:01, and you're listening to WBAI New York. Up next, Any Saturday, with our friend David Rothenberg.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song. Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy. even when things go wrong.
Sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you'll even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him. And without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and the kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
His name is or was Jimmy Durante. Mine is David Rothenberg. And believe it or not, it's the last weekend of the summer. And what's happening today? Well, down in Washington, a collection of people rally. Justice for January 6th. I hear music somewhere in the background, James.
David,
what is
it's
that?
It's all in your imagination.
No, I heard music. I hear music and there's nothing there. Anyway, there's a rally in Washington today, Justice for the January 6th protesters, the seditionists, those that climbed the walls of our Capitol, those that wanted to murder Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi. I wonder if part of the ceremonies they'll pay homage to the defendants at Nuremberg and Axis Sally. I have to remind them that that was all about a fake election or a fixed election or whatever term Donnie was calling it. He lost by 7 million votes. 7 million votes. They have to come to terms with that. And I want to point something else out. You know, it's traditional for the president of the United States to, or the outgoing president, to be silent about his successor, to give them an opportunity to assume the responsibilities they once had. In recent years, George Bush did not comment about Obama's presidency. Obama was painfully silent about Trump. It's a tradition. Trump has not been so silent. He hasn't been as ubiquitous because he doesn't have the access to the media. But some of his he's not Twittering, but whatever he gets on, some of it gets quoted. And you get the feeling in his criticism of Biden that he wants America to fail. He wants the country to fail. That's what I get from him. He is so self-absorbed. Well, we don't have to go into all of that. That's given. It's also the 10th anniversary. Some of the people who participated in the Wall Street sit-ins a decade ago are calling attention to its 10th anniversary. What a difference their demonstration was from the people of January 6th. Let me say this. This has been an emotional week for me, maybe for you as well. Reliving 9/11 is not easy. They keep telling us, don't forget it. I wish I could. I can't. I can't bear looking at the pictures. As soon as the television shows the planes going into the Twin Towers, I shut it off. It's cemented in my mind. I don't need film reminders. And much more personally to me has been the 50th anniversary of Attica, having sat in the yard 50 years ago and then listening to the people that I sat with be slaughtered by the state of New York, and to relive it every September. And this year, because it was the 50th anniversary, it got more attention. It keeps coming back. It doesn't go away. The emotional fluids, I suddenly realized yesterday I was drained from, I participated in about a dozen Zoom interviews about Attica, and it catches up with you eventually, because you're reliving painful things, the death, unnecessary deaths caused by your state of people you had just sat with. I need some R&R for the next couple of days and some sweet music, James. So why don't we play Fats Waller, because Fats with his, you know, when he sings, there's a smile in his voice or a chuckle. He's making, as he sings, he's making comment on all of us with sardonic and spry humor. Here he is with one of his most successful numbers. That it's called Honeysuckle Rose. Everybody sung it at one point or another. And Fats gives it, here's the original of Honeysuckle Rose.
Piano playing is giggling.
isn't it? I've always said, and I may have said this on the, that I suspect when Fat Swallow was a New York kid, when he was a little boy in school, I can imagine the teacher snapping their fingers and saying, stop that. What was his first name? I knew it, and I can't. I'm sure the teachers didn't call him Fats, but whatever it was. Wait, I have his CD. What does it say? Well, I'll find it. But I can just imagine the teachers saying he was probably the little imp in the class that was making everyone laugh with his Thomas Fatswaller. Can't you hear the teacher? Thomas, turn around, sit down, and pay attention. And all the other kids were giggling and laughing because Thomas was the joy of the classroom. Probably didn't get much out of the class. I identify with a lot of that. I was not a good student in grammar school and high school. Miss Anderson told my mother in the supermarket one day. My mother came home and reported that everyone heard Miss Anderson say, "You see these gray hairs? Your son is responsible for half of them." Now, that sounds funny, but that should never be inflicted on a child, especially Miss Anderson's gray hairs. They weren't attractive when they were dark brown either, so I don't know what the problem was with her. And so it goes. Talking about piano players, our friend at WBAI Faithful and a friend of mine, George Young, who plays a nice piano, does a little singing too. His singing is not Sinatra-ish, but it's awfully, and it's not Fats Waller-ish, but it's George Young-ish. And he's going to be at Don't Tell Mama on the 30th. That's a Thursday at 7 o'clock, so some of us can stay up that late. He's awfully good. George Young swinging Broadway tunes. If you're ready to go out, and talking about going out, have you heard about what happened? I don't know if it was last night or Thursday at Carmine's restaurant. Three tourists from Texas